Good morning and welcome to this month's Hancock & Whitney Bank's Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions during the call, please email them to david.lundgren@hancockbank.com and we will take those questions at the end of the call. Today on the call, we have Chief Investment Officer John Portwood and Investment Directors David Lundgren, Luther McDougall, Greg Halewski, and Jeff Tangus. And now I will hand it over to the moderator, Dave Lundgren.
Great. Thank you, Ashley. Good morning, everyone. John, 2012 is in the books, and I think all in all, it's a pretty good year. And the major storyline, at least at the end of 2012, is still with us, unfortunately, and that's the fiscal cliff. So I think we'll go ahead and start there. And really, I guess that it wasn't at the end of the year. It was the beginning of the year when legislation was actually enacted. And I think we solved half the equation. So maybe if we could, let's start on what legislation was passed, maybe just kind of a brief overview and what it means to investors.
Okay, Dave, let's start with the top income tax rates. What the new legislation did to resolve the fiscal cliff was to reinstate the top 39.6% rate on taxable income above $450,000 for joint filers. For lower and middle income tax rates, and that would be anybody under $450,000 jointly, you've got a permanent extension of the tax rates that, you know, existed or that have existed, I guess, since 2003. There was a change on capital gains and dividends. Capital gains and dividend rates, tax rates remained at 15% for those making, less than $450,000 a year. And they rise to 20% for $450,000 or more joint income. Now, added to that, we've also got the 3.5% tax on investment income that was signed into law to support Obamacare a year or so back, and that's going to apply to everybody that makes over $250,000 from an investment income standpoint. And then you've got a 0.9% addition to the Medicare tax that comes out of wages and not really related to individual filers. There's a medical device tax that goes into effect this year that amounts to 3.5% of revenues for all medical device sales. And in case you're interested in what is included as a medical device at this point, that includes people who make wooden tongue depressors. So there is a huge battle going on now about that because, and by the way, some key Democratic senators have asked for some relief on that measure because they found, suddenly to their surprise, I guess, that a lot of these companies that make medical devices are located in the Northeast, which is a heavily Democratic area, and some of these companies depend on volume for their sales. You know, they're not high-tech, low-volume operations. They're low-tech, high-volume, and their profit margins are 3 to 4%. So you take 3.5% away from a 3.5 to 4% profit margin, and you know what you got. So word is that at least one company has already laid off 1,000 people. So, you know, we'll see what happens to that tax going forward, but at least it, you know, it sort of complicates the picture going forward. That's basically it. Oh, I should mention the estate tax. The estate tax rate is permanently set. Again, all of these tax rates, by the way, are permanent, of course, to the extent that, you know, they don't automatically go out at some time in the future. So we'll see how permanent that really is. But the estate tax, 40% on amounts over $5 million. You've got a $5 million exemption per spouse indexed to inflation. And you've got a permanent patch to the AMT problem, the alternative minimum tax, that increases the exemption amount and indexes it to inflation. So
okay. And I think I heard a number, correct me if I'm wrong, that the revenue, I guess the increased revenue generated by the new tax laws is about $600 billion. Does that sound about right?
That's the guess going forward. Of course, you know, this year, of course, a lot of business was probably forwarded over into 2012 to avoid taxes, and so you're probably going to have more tax revenue than they anticipated in 2012 because a lot of income was, you know, was accrued in 2012 rather than 2013. So certainly the amount of revenue they expect in 2013 is not going to be what they say. I mean, it's probably not going to be that high, but anyway, that's a...
Okay. And, you know, not that tax legislation is ever easy, but in terms of looking at the two sides of the equation of the fiscal cliff, perhaps that was a little bit easier to reach compromise between the two parties. I guess the fear, the concern is that the real battle is going to start occurring, if it hasn't already, in regards to the sequester, spending cuts, debt ceiling. Give us a little insight on where we are, what you think is going to happen over the next few weeks in regards to that.
The spending side of the equation was a big issue, as I think everyone probably knows. Unless you've been living in a cave for the last few weeks, you probably heard quite a bit of discussion about you know, changing the tax law and what was going to be done about spending. The law, as it was passed, actually increased spending, and there was a lot of pork in that bill. I won't go into it now, but part of the pork involved some sort of tax credit for Hollywood movie producers. So that kind of gives you an idea of what's included in these bills that we don't, you know, often see in detail. But in any case, the spending issue was a huge deal. It's going to be an even bigger deal when the discussions begin about raising the debt ceiling, which will happen in a couple of months, and what to do about sequestration, which is the automatic 10% reduction in spending across the board that is designed to occur if they don't come to some sort of agreement about what to do about spending going forward. But unfortunately, at this point, the president has said he is not going to negotiate about spending. And he's only interested, so he said, in adding more taxes. And that's what the Democrats have talked about. The Republicans on the other side have suggested that they're not going to talk about taxes. They only want to talk about spending. So this is going to be probably another period of turmoil and nastiness in the political arena that will probably have some impact, some fallout, I guess, for the economy, you know, and potentially the market. So to a degree, we're sort of still in an era where we're hostage to politics and politics, you know, very often, and I guess that's where we are right now. You know, getting back to what kind of drag all of this might be on GDP growth going forward. If we never had a resolution of the fiscal cliff and the tax rates had suddenly changed and gone back to the 2003 rates, economists estimate the drag on GDP would have been about 3 to 4%, which would certainly have pushed us into recession. We've still got a drag, so you know, the resolution of the fiscal cliff removed a potential negative, but we still ended a big negative, I guess, but we still ended up with a negative. So now the estimated drag on the economy is probably somewhere in the 1 to 2% range. So, you know, until things get normalized, we're still probably in a relatively, you know, low growth world. But it's going to be interesting in the next couple of months. You know, whether this results in a downgrading of the U.S. you know, debt rating, you know, who knows? It's certainly possible, I suppose. But then everybody else around the world is being periodically downgraded anyway. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see whether it amounts to much. But in any case, we can look forward to a couple more months, I guess, of turmoil and distress as far as the political world is concerned.
Well, that's exciting, John. Never a dull moment. So, hey, Greg Hadleski, good morning.
Good morning.
You heard John's comments, and, you know, I think what's interesting is, you know, 2012, you know, in addition to the fiscal cliff issues that we faced at the end of the year, we also had the Eurozone heated up once again, I guess, middle of the year. We had a very contentious election. But despite it all, we had, I think, a really good year for the market. If you look at the S&P 500 large cap stocks, we were up about 16%. And kind of surprisingly, towards the end of the year, both small cap and international stocks really rallied. Small caps finished just slightly ahead of large caps, as represented by the Russell 2000 at 16.3. And then international stocks, depending on which index that you looked at, it was in the 17 to 18% range. So, you know, again, a really good year for the market despite all of the turbulence. And if you could, maybe, you know, just looking back, give us a little insight into what propelled the market forward, and then maybe even give us a little bit more detail in regards to some of the sectors that performed well or didn't perform well during the year.
Yeah, it was kind of an up and down year. The first quarter we were up actually about 12%, and then we had a sell-off in the second quarter, so it's been a roller coaster, and then the third quarter again we were up about 6%, and then the last quarter was kind of flat to negative. The star really was the mid-cap index, which came in at about 18%, S&P 400, NASDAQ and the Russell were at 17.5 and 16.3, and then the S&P at 16.3. The big loser, or if you want to call it a loser, was the Dow, which was only up about 10%. As far as the S&P sectors go, financials, discretionary, telecom, and healthcare were the strong performers, everywhere from 28, almost 29% in financials, 24% in discretionary stocks. The laggards were really energy and utilities. But, yeah, it was kind of remarkable all year that the market seemed to shrug off all the problems. And I think, you know, Europe went kind of in the back burner. I think maybe there was some optimism that the recovery, you know, would take stronger hold. Again, I think to some degree the election provides some clarity now. I think some businesses at least know the kind of framework that they need to operate in. So, again, the market's, you know, always a discounting mechanism, and it's looking ahead 6 to 9 months. So I think for the most part it was probably looking forward to 2013, and there is a lot of talk still that, you know, we've had some weakness in corporate earnings this year. But for the most part, they've been reasonably strong given the weak recovery that we've had. And there's even some talk among analysts that we're going to resume positive earnings growth in 2013. But, again, that remains to be seen on whether or not, you know, a lot of the political issues, which, again, don't necessarily drive the market, but, again, they do tend to cloud the picture and, you know, either hamper or can help the markets. But, again, the markets are going to focus on basically how businesses are doing, and hopefully, you know, some of these issues, again, have been clarified to some degree. Obviously, we would like the political situation to have been with some stronger solutions in that respect, but, you know, maybe they're looking forward to a little more positive year in 2013, or we can hope.
Well, John, let's go ahead, and if you could, let's talk a little bit about 2013, and we heard your comments in regards to at least the next couple months, but maybe try and give us a longer-term view on, you know, getting beyond some of this political stuff. What do you think is going to happen for the market for 2013? I know you hate that question. It's always difficult what's going to happen over a 12-month period, but I think, you know, just give us maybe some ranges and some probabilities. I think that would be helpful.
Okay. If obviously some sort of policy mistake could intervene and cause the situation to be much more negative than anybody imagines. I mean, I guess it is conceivable that, you know, both parties involved in negotiations about the debt ceiling could dig in their heels and decide to do absolutely nothing, and to use the bank credit analyst's favorite word, markets would riot and force them, you know, finally into making a decision. So, you know, whether or not it gets to that point or not is anybody's guess. But, you know, one thing for sure, the debt ceiling is going to be raised. I mean, it has to be. You know, it's just a matter of, you know, how do we get there and how much turmoil occurs when it finally happens, and something will be done about the, you know, sequestration issue. So we know that's going to get resolved. It just might be a lot of turmoil around it. But other than what might happen on that front, if you look at what's happening economically around the world, the situation is really better than it was last year. And Greg alluded to that. When you look at the leading economic indicators for the U.S., for example, you don't really yet see any indication that we have a recession right around the corner. Of course, circumstances could intervene and change the picture, but right now it looks like muddle through is probably a pretty good guess as to what will happen economically. From the market standpoint, again, when you try to make guesses about what's going to happen over the next year, it's kind of a coin toss. A firm recently published a scorecard for all of the gurus who make guesses about the coming year and found out that 50% were right and 50% were wrong. So, again, it is kind of something of a coin toss. But we can look at a number of things and try to get an idea of what the probabilities look like. Last year, say November, December of 2011, rather, as we approach 2012, the valuation readings for the market generally were such that you could make a pretty good case for at least a positive return. And in fact, at the time, we were talking about a positive return for the market and probably in the single-digit area as far as the major indices were concerned, reflecting probably a single-digit gain in earnings per share for the market and so forth. And it turned out that earnings were in the single digits, and what really pushed the market higher was the change in ratings. So you actually had a little bit of increase in the price earnings multiple over the year, which produced more return than we would have thought. This year, the valuation number is somewhat worse or less attractive than it was last year coming into the end of the year. And if you had to make a guess going forward, you'd have to say probably flat to maybe slightly negative. So my guess would be, in contrast to last year, where you would say lean more positive than negative, this year looks like one of those years where you could be minus 5 or plus 5. And again, that's just a guess, and my preceding comment about how accurate that might be goes without saying, but it looks like probably something flat to maybe slightly positive is not a bad guess. For the markets as a whole.
And for us to do better than that, it's going to be a combination of a better-than-expected economy or people willing to pay more for stocks to where you see this price-to-earnings ratio move right up to get in that 10 to 20% range like we experienced this year.
Yeah. And we, on the downside, too, we have to recognize that the Fed is likely to be in an easing mode for most of the year, if not all of the year. And the same thing is happening around the world. So to some degree, we have a floor under the market, I think, for a while. Now, in the long run, of course, what the Fed and the other central banks are doing around the world will probably produce unintended consequences. And we may have some issues down the road from what they're doing today. But at least, currently it looks like, what they're doing is probably more of a positive than a negative in the near term. Long-term negative, near-term probably positive.
Okay. Thank you, John. And before we move on to bonds, just a reminder, if anybody has any questions, please go ahead and email them to me at david.lundgren@hancockbank.com. Luther, good morning.
Good morning.
Similar to like we did on the stock side, if you could maybe give us a brief summary of how the fixed income markets performed in 2012, what worked, what didn't.
Okay. For the fixed income market or the taxable market in general, I'm going to refer to the Barclays Capital U.S. Aggregate Bond Index, which is a widely used benchmark. It has about 8,000 bonds and $15 trillion in market value, so it is an all-encompassing index. Returns last year came from two places. One would be credit quality, and the other would be changes in spreads. And when I say spreads, and we mentioned spreads, we're talking about the fact that most bonds, specifically corporates, mortgage backs, et cetera, trade versus a comparable treasury. So if you started the year with a corporate bond that was trading at 2% above a comparable treasury and it ended the year trading at only 1% above a comparable treasury, then you had some price appreciation. Overall, during the course of last year, the government yield curve remained basically unchanged. The 10-year started the year at 1.9 and ended the year at 1.8. The 30-year started the year at 2.9 and ended the year at 2.95. So the 10-year yield actually fell slightly, while the 30-year yield actually rose just a little bit. So last year for government bonds, you basically got your coupon. The return on the Treasury index was 2%. The return on the mortgage-backed securities was 2.59%. And where you got all of your return last year, at least in investment-grade bonds, was on the corporate side. Corporate bonds had a return of 9.82%. Now, a lot of that had to do with what I was mentioning before, spreads narrowing. And to give you an example of that, the return on AAA corporates last year was 2.38%. Not a lot of narrowing in the difference between AAA corporates and comparable treasuries, but the return on BBB corporates was 11.48%. So last year in the taxable market, where you really wanted to be was effectively lower quality bonds, or the lower quality portion of the investment grade curve, and the kind of longer bonds too. It's kind of an example of that. If you switch to the high yield index, you know, I mentioned that corporates within the Barclays Capital Aggregate had a 9.82%. The high yield index had a 15.81% return, with long high yield bonds having a return of near 25%. So the longer you had and the lower quality you bought last year, really, you had better returns. And short to intermediate bond, short to intermediate term bonds just really didn't have a lot of capital appreciation there. And as I said, mostly an income return. Within the tax-exempt market, you had something similar in that intermediate term rates didn't change a whole lot. And here I'm using the Barclays Capital Municipal Index, which is only $1.3 trillion but has about 45,000 bonds in it. What you saw last year was the 10-year curve for municipals remained unchanged, but long-term municipal bonds actually declined, with a 30-year municipal falling from 382 to 316. So here, again, what we're going to have is the longer the bond, the better the return. Short municipal bonds, as measured by 1 to 5 year municipals, had a return of less than 2%. Intermediate-term bonds were around 4.5%. Long-term bonds, those in maturity 10-plus years, had a return of 9.5%. And municipal bonds with a maturity of over 20 years had an 11% return. But the overall municipal market had a great year with a 6.78% return. So municipals did better on a pre-tax and after-tax basis versus the Barclays aggregate. So it was, in both cases, high-quality, long-term, I mean, lower-quality, longer-term bonds had the best returns in 2012, regardless of what market we were in.
Thank you, Luther. Jeff, obviously, you know, 2012, as Luther discussed, a lot of the return was driven from your, you know, your spread product, specifically corporates. Not much change in government yields. What do you think, what's going to be our source of return or income in 2013?
Well, let me just say, as Luther pointed out, it was a great year for corporate bonds. It was a great year for really anything other than government bonds. And as most people realize, we focus on non-government securities in our fixed income investments. So it's going to be tough for us to beat such a stellar year as last year, given the dramatic rise in bond prices that we saw. So looking out at 2013, I guess it's more of a moderate view of investment returns. It's going to be tough to beat last year's returns all the way around. But there's basically three factors that are going to drive the market, I think, in 2013, and they're not terribly different than the factors that we have seen really over the last couple of years. John mentioned the Fed and the Fed's activity, the Fed's accommodation. The Fed is certainly manipulating the fixed income markets. They've said so out loud. They're trying to trying to juice the economy somewhat to get unemployment down. And so they have implemented their buying program where they're buying about $40 billion a month in mortgage securities, government mortgage securities, and about $45 billion a month in longer-term treasuries. And the great speculation is how long are they going to continue that. Now, recently we had a little scare where one of the Fed governors mentioned that, well, you know, we might not do this as long as some people think. And that got the market's attention, and we saw a quick backup in rates. I think the Fed is around all this year. I don't see them stopping this year. I think Bernanke is pretty much committed to keeping very short rates low for maybe a couple years. But their out loud goal, of course, is to get unemployment down in the 6% range with a six handle on it. And that there's no way anybody that I know of, certainly none of us here internally, think that we're going to see unemployment with a six handle this year. So that tells me the Fed's still in the game, the Fed's still buying, and the Fed provides support for the bond market, just like they're providing some support, I suppose, for the equity markets. So that's one big factor. The second factor is, as John also mentioned, all the political wrangling that's going to take place in Washington here in the next over the next couple of months. Personally, I believe that that Moody's will downgrade the U.S. debt. They've said it's on negative watch. They said the $600 billion budget package that was passed at the first of this month is not nearly enough to do anything. They need to see some real action on both the spending and probably even on the revenue side for them to take the U.S. off of credit watch for a downgrade. But like the S&P downgrade, which we saw last year, I think in August of 2011, it's really not going to have much of an effect. Nobody is going to quit buying treasuries just because Moody's downgraded it. It's pretty much factored in. So there'll be a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth, but in the end of the day, it's really not going to change. That is not going to change what interest rates do for this year anyway. Third factor, of course, is going to be the economy and how is our economy, as well as, I guess, the global and European economy especially, how is that going to do this year? Apparently, it looks like the first quarter here is going to be a little on the sluggish side. Latter back half of this year is probably going to be stronger. Certainly seems like housing's getting better. I have a just kind of a sense that the economy in the U.S. is getting better. So that's probably going to put a little bit of pressure on rates over the next 12 months, but not a tremendous amount. I think the consensus is Bloomberg of 50 or 60 economists out there. Consensus by the end of this year is somewhere, I believe it's around 220 on the 10-year Treasury, which we're about 190 right now to round it off. So that's a bit of a rise in Treasury rates. I'm not sure that transfers directly into other corporate rates and things of that sort. I think we could see a little bit of spread compression, but that's probably going to be the biggest factor. This year is how good does the economy get in the back half, and then the natural pressure that will have on interest rates. So we're probably going to see you're going to collect your coupon this year. You may give a little bit back in the form of a little bit bond prices getting nicked a little bit, but we certainly don't see a big year either way, very good or very bad this year. Probably an average year with the collecting the coupon, and then again a little bit of negative bias on the price side.
Thanks, Jeff. One thing that might help to clarify, maybe not all of our listeners know what you mean when you said that the Fed would be looking for unemployment to have a six handle, just if you could clarify that a little bit.
Well, yeah, what the Fed has said out loud is their mandate is inflation and keep inflation low, or price stability, and then unemployment provide unemployment. I think we're in the high sevens right now, 7%. I think 7.7 or 7.8 on unemployment right now. And again, the Fed has said They really want to see unemployment under 7%, so a 6.5, 6.7, again, something under 7% for them to really start thinking seriously about not continuing their accommodative stance. And John's a much better economist at these sorts of things than I am, but from what I gathered, it would take a lot to get employment down under 7% given the current rate of employment growth.
Okay, great. We do have one question, and John, we're running a little long on time, but the question is, you had discussed a market return between positive 5% and negative 5%, you know, probably being the most realistic outlook for 2013. And the question is, what should we expect from the Hancock Whitney investment team? And I'm actually going to change the question a little bit. Why don't you discuss what should we expect from active managers?
Okay. What the index does, of course, only has a bearing on investors who, I guess, for want of a better term, are somewhat closet indexers. And I'm talking about investment managers who might adhere to a policy or philosophy that leads them to build portfolios that look like the market, you know, the same sector weightings, the same industry weightings, or something like that. Our particular process does not really benchmark against any particular index. You know, we're looking for the best relative value among sectors and industries, and in doing so, we're going to be overweight sectors and industries that have the best value, just to simplify things, and underweight and have you know, less money invested in sectors and industries that appear to offer relatively poor value. So the fact that we don't look like the market necessarily at any particular point in time suggests, of course, that our returns are not likely to mirror that of the market or necessarily, you know, come in, you know, anywhere near what the benchmark is doing. Obviously, we'd like to do better than the benchmark over a long period of time, and over a period of 1 year, it's hard to make a judgment about what might happen going forward. But certainly there is the potential for us to do better than the index if we happen to be invested in, you know, different sectors and industries that happen to outperform. And obviously we can't promise that, but one thing we do from an active management standpoint is look for the best relative value, and we don't benchmark. So there's certainly an opportunity for us to do you know, better than the benchmark going forward. I mean, conversely, of course, in any short period of time, we might do a little worse. But in any case, you know, we follow a pretty disciplined process, and we adhere to that over a long period of time, and really don't deviate at all. Another example of how the market indexes don't really control what happens is what Greg mentioned earlier when he talked about the return for the different sectors over 2012, and Greg, you might have the numbers there handy, but finance, for example, in 2012 was up 25% or so, and energy was only up 8%. And that's a pretty classic example of what happens within the capitalization-weighted indices in terms of what happens to different sectors, to give you an idea of how you can be positioned in different sectors and have returns that are totally different from that of the index.
Yeah, energy was actually about 4.6.
Oh, I couldn't. I knew it was low. I couldn't remember.
Yeah, it was
exactly.
real low. The only other one that was below that was utilities at 1.3. But again, the big ones, the ones that really were beating the 16% return of the S&P 500, were financials at 28.8, discretionary, which of course we had a big position in, and 23.9. telecom at 18.3, and then healthcare at 17.9. So even the remainder of the indices, if you just look below the 16% cutoff of the S&P 500, industrials were at 15.3, materials at 15, and technology at 14.8, and staples at 10.8. So, you know, it's a good point, though, that we're going to be in the sectors that we think are going to do the best.
All right, I think we'll go ahead and end it there. Thank you, everybody, for attending today, and we look forward to talking to you next month.